At Irregular Hours, episode 134 for October 20th, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
And I'm Count Chip Hessenblow.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
And we are here with the third part of our spooky book with reading through Dracula.
We're recording at nighttime, the witching hour, as we like to call it.
Blah, blah, blah. I don't say blah, blah, blah. And since we've made this a tradition now, that our third episode, we have a special guest, and this episode is no different. We have Dr. Rhodes herself, Sarah Rhodes, from the Svengoolie tweet group, the Sven Pals. Every Saturday night, Sarah and I and, what, like 50 other people get together, watch Svengoolie across this great land, and tweet together all of our fun jokes. Good morning, Sarah. How are you?
Good morning. Or as I should say, from Oklahoma, how y'all doing?
let's begin with the first thing. Who is Svengoolie, Steve?
Svengoolie is our local horror host here in Chicago. And now, since he is syndicated across the country, the rest of the world knows all about the idea of watching these classic horror movies together on a Saturday night, as one does. Svengoolie's been doing this since the 1970s, and we've had audio from him in the past because he's such a great, great guy here in Chicago. And Sarah, you found out about Svengoolie at some point. What's your backstory with Svengoolie?
Well, I was channel surfing one night. I didn't know what to watch. And I scroll across and I come to our local MeTV affiliate. And I see Svengoolie. I don't remember what he's showing. I think it was Dr. Cyclops. And I thought, my gosh, this is a cool show. I've known about hosted movies forever, but this is the first one that really captured my attention.
So the rest of the country that doesn't get Svengoolie, you might be familiar with Joe Bob Briggs, who hosts horror films, or Elvira is one of the broader comedy horror hosts. And then, Chip, there was one that you had growing up, right? What was that one?
Well, every market had their version of it. If you were in the New York area or an area that received it, it was Zachary.
So we have our horror host. He's been doing this for 40 years now. Are we on year 42, Sarah?
41.
41
we're
years.
We're at 41, yes.
And every Saturday night, we come together apart, and we watch Svengoolie together and live tweet our fun as we're watching it. Which brings us to a little over a week from now, Sarah. We've got Halloween 2020 coming up. Tell us what we're planning.
Well, I'm planning a Together Apart Halloween Twitter party celebrating Svengoolie, since it happens to land on a Saturday, Svengoolie Saturday. Here recently for his 41st anniversary celebration, I got some of the Sven pals together using the hashtag Svengoolie, as we do on Saturday nights, and posted artwork, fun games, whatever related to the program. And I'm thinking we can do similar for Halloween, except maybe have costume contests, or maybe talk about your favorite scary movies or Halloween traditions with the family.
So across the country, Saturday night, October 31st, we are gathering together apart. Follow us with hashtag Svengoolie. There's going to be a lot of great fun that night. But we're not going to be watching Dracula, because he's not showing Dracula on Saturday night, October 31st. The movie for that night is Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman. That's what we're going to be watching on Svengoolie.
Still a classic.
Absolutely a classic, but not nearly as classic as Dracula, which is what we're here to discuss today. The 1931 Dracula movie certainly is an interesting adaptation from the book, the original book that we've been reading up until this point, right, Pam?
Absolutely, and I think that for many, many people, when you think Dracula, you picture Bela Lugosi, right? And Chip, I know this was your first time reading the actual 1897 novel. Was that your experience?
Well, when I read Dracul, yes, I read it as, Bela Lugosi. Because his mastery of the English language has worked out real well. It's certain, lots of paprika in that accent.
Yes, that Hungarian accent, that Transylvania accent, is definitely the right choice for this part. And he was the right choice to play this character in this movie because he started in the 1927 stage adaptation of Dracula. He was the Broadway Dracula. You could imagine going to the theater and watching the Dracula with Bela Lugosi. That would have been amazing. When time travel's invented, that's where I'm headed.
He had the costume already.
They hired him because he already had the cape.
The funny thing for me is I've been reading this novel for years, and I love talking about this, all the Victorian elements of this novel with students. This is the first time I've watched the 1931 film. I'm very embarrassed to say it. So thank you, Sarah, for drawing my attention to it. Wow, I have so much to say about this film, but I want to hear what other people think. The Dracula was amazing, but wow, really interesting decisions in terms of what scenes to show and what scenes to ignore.
Yes.
Well, it was an interesting time because it was the time before color. So the world was black and white at that time.
Yes, that's just the way the world looked in 1931. That's right. That's very true. Sarah, what's your history with Dracula?
Well, I first read it a number of years ago. I want to say 10, 12 maybe. And I read it around Halloween time because I thought if I'm going to read it, I'm doing it for spooky season. I was really impressed with it, and I see how it opened a lot of doors for other scary books, movies, whatever.
But what about the Bela Lugosi movie?
I enjoyed it. I first watched it, oh gosh, probably 20 years ago. And one of my favorite things is whenever they have the light shining on his eyes, it adds to the creepy factor and how you never really see him bite somebody as it fades to black. Leaves it to the imagination.
And that's one of the things that, Pam, you noticed watching this, right?
Well, yeah. And so they always have, they mention, oh, yes, there's those, we have the little fang marks. You know, we have those two little spots on people's throats. But, you know, just it's a very Victorian move, I think, to sort of turn away from actual sexuality. And as we've been talking about throughout these episodes, the vampire stands in for sexuality in a lot of ways, as we talked about at length last week. And I do think that here we see that in the movie quite nicely. For example, the scene where Van Helsing is looking at Mina and he says, she's sitting on the couch and she's got like something, a scarf or whatever around her throat. And he says, let me look at your throat. No, she says modestly. And he like unwraps it. But we don't see, the viewer doesn't see. We see Van Helsing see the bite mark. And so we're just, and every time something gets a little bit intimate, camera turns away.
Like the Muppets, everything interesting takes place off stage, right?
Just off camera.
I was just about to go to the Muppets, Jeff. Exactly right.
The interesting thing for me looking at this 1931 version is the law of economy of characters that we see here. The characters are all mixed up from the original because there's only so many people you can hire to be in a movie. The law of economy of characters says that you have to shorten some of that lengthy storytelling with the characters and change up some of the things. In the 1931 movie, Renfield becomes kind of the central character. Not the protagonist, really, but he's kind of the center of the story. We see the story from his perspective a lot, and he replaces Harker as the character who goes to Transylvania to make the deal with Dracula to come to London.
And I thought it was interesting that they had Renfield on the boat, that sort of ancient mariner ship. That was kind of an interesting move. That was one of the shifts they made that I really liked. I thought, ooh, that makes a lot of sense. However, and so Renfield, of course, such a fascinating character. And I think it's easy to read through Dracula and not pay very much attention to Renfield. to see it as, to see the whole, the scenes with Renfield as sort of a counterpoint to your main narrative. But I wanted to mention to you guys that Barbara Hamley has this very interesting novel called simply Renfield, which is the Dracula story from Renfield's perspective. So a very cool sort of pastiche or fan fiction that I would definitely recommend if you're interested in that character. And now watching the 1931 film, I'm like, ooh, I wonder if she was inspired by this in her writing of that novel.
I think a lot of people saw the 1931 Dracula first as, yeah, as their knowledge of Dracula, and then expanded out into the novel. And then, of course, the really Victorian, modern Bram Stoker's Dracula movie certainly tried to go back to the original text and add, the Vlad the Impaler part, which is still questionable. I'm still like, really? Was Vlad the Impaler Dracula? Or is that really?
You know, if we can go back to your point, Steve, about economy of characters, I'd be super curious for all of us as we've watched the film and read the novel, who did you miss in the movie? You know, we left out Quincy Morris entirely, pretty much left out or entirely left out Lord Godalming.
Isn't that interesting that the three characters who are vying for Lucy's affection, those three characters are so important to the novel and to the storytelling. And yeah, they are minor at best, and the American is not there at all, right?
By thunder. I'm going to go shoot bats with my gun outside the window.
Oh, that was such a weird scene in this piece. That was such a weird moment where they're all together in the room, and then there's a gunshot that comes through the window, and they're like, oh, somebody's shooting. Oh, it's the American. He's outside. When did he leave? Where did he go? He saw a bat outside, and he's shooting at it, and the bullet is going through the window into the room where they're standing? What?
He must be from Texas.
Sorry, Sarah.
He goes, I can get this bat. Here, let me grab my shotgun and let me grab and take this one out.
I was thinking it, but I didn't say it.
Sarah, because you work in Texas, right?
Correct.
You're on the air at KBEC Radio, classic Texas music. Do you have both kinds of music?
Country and Western. Good. From Bob's Country Bunker.
Good. Sarah's allowed to stay. She understands the Chicago joke that I was trying to make. Pam sometimes doesn't get my Chicago jokes, Sarah.
Well, you sometimes don't get my Canadian jokes.
They're all about moose.
It's a low blow there, Steve.
The moose is a majestic creature. I stand by it. But... did you guys miss Quincy and Lord Godalming? Because, in the novel, we really had this team, right? This team that's working against Dracula. And there's that notion of like collaboration. You have the scientist, the lawyer, the psychiatrist, the American, profession unknown, the aristocrat. You have the
adventurer. Yeah. The American's the adventurer.
Right. Adventurer. Right. Right. Exactly. Right. But you have something which becomes really fundamental to vampire fiction after, really displayed in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but other places too. And now in this movie, you really just have Van Helsing and everyone else is watching in admiration as he fights Dracula. It's way more like a one-on-one compared to that collaborative effort of like, how do you fight the vampire? A totally different dynamic. And I'm curious what you guys saw as the sort of pros and cons of that approach.
Well, if I had a name like Van Helsing, I would be like the superhero too.
And we do see him as the leader of this team in the novel. He is certainly the one who's coming with the knowledge, but they need the whole team to work together. What do you think, Sarah?
Well, I think with the team, it would have been too busy in the movie. I like it with just Van Helsing.
And Van Helsing goes on in movies to become such an important character. He's such an interesting, intriguing character. I could see the birth of that in this 1931 movie.
He looks a lot like Hugh Jackman.
Maybe not exactly.
No. He does. I do buy him as a professor who has been studying alone in a closed room all of this stuff. He's not the most powerful of...
There's the movie Van Helsing, and Hugh Jackman plays Van Helsing.
I got you. Thank you for explaining that notion to us. In this movie, he's played by Edward Van Sloan, who happens to be one of two actors who appeared in both Dracula in 1931 and Frankenstein that same year. The other one is Dwight Frye, who was the one who's playing Renfield here. He goes on to play Fritz... Don't call me Igor, Fritz in Frankenstein, which came out in that same year, interestingly enough.
Fascinating. And I wonder if that's a reason. I feel like my students always think that Dracula and Frankenstein came out really close together, when in fact, Frankenstein is 1819 and Dracula is 1897. So they're like bookends of the Victorian period. But students always think of them as being of an era. And maybe it's because those two really prototypical film versions came out the same year.
9 months really? Apart.
If you were a young person during that time, and you know, Saturday morning movies were certainly the treat of the moment. Yeah, I could see how you could easily, you know, I want to say confuse how closely they were written, because the movies come out so quickly.
And they've been so closely tied since then.
You show up for Valentine's Day, you get to see... Dracula.
How interesting is that? Let's pause there.
And then Christmas, you get Frankenstein.
No. Thanksgiving. Let's not skip over Thanksgiving.
American Thanksgiving.
That's right. That's
we're
right.
Too late for Canadian Thanksgiving.
for all of our international listeners. That's right.
Yeah, but Dracula is a Valentine's Day movie. That's so interesting.
So if you get Frankenstein for Christmas, some assembly required.
Yes. It's alive.
Old zipper neck. So this movie is classic. It's iconic. Pam, is this a good movie?
Every movie's a good movie, Steve. You know that.
That's not true. That is not true.
Oh, no. You need to watch a few more Adam Sandler movies and things might change.
So I would say that it's a movie that gives you a ton to think about, especially if you're watching it in conjunction with reading the novel, because I think the decisions they make are fascinating. Sarah, I loved your point about it's too busy with the whole team. But like, also that creates this notion of like a male hero, right? Like in terms of what does Dracula represent, right? Some sort of threat, a sexual threat, threat of immigrants, contagion. You know, there's this like Dracula we can read in many, many different ways. And so how do you battle a threat? And what Stoker shows us is that like, you shouldn't ignore 50% of your population. You need women. You need Mina Harker. I got to tell you, we still have a quarter of this book to go, but spoiler alert, without kill Dracula, okay, in the novel. Whereas in this 1931 movie, oh, poor little Mina, she's sitting on the couch feeling a little faint. Oh, she needs a big man to save her. It's a totally different dynamic. So is it a good movie? Yeah, it makes me think about stuff. I think it's a great movie for that reason. But I mean, it's a totally different gender dynamic.
Did they kind of play with combining Lucy and Mina in the movie?
Absolutely. Yeah, those two characters that we see as two very dynamically different characters in the book are just pushed to the background so much, and they kind of combine what happens to each of them in interesting ways. And they take out Lucy's sexuality completely. Like the whole idea of these three suitors coming to Lucy because she is so beautiful, completely taken out of the 1931.
And in the part of the novel that we read for today, we get that wonderful moment where, of course, we 2020 readers know perfectly well that, of course, Lucy's been turned into a vampire and is attacking small children. But thinking about it in 1897, Stoker really builds up through John Seward's diary as he's like, oh, these children are, they too have those two little marks on their neck. Dracula must be going out and biting children. And then you realize, it's Lucy, right? That notion that this beautiful girl that Quincy loves, and that Seward loves, God, you know, this beautiful girl is actually the boofer lady, the bloofer lady, the beautiful lady. She's actually become a predator. That's terrifying. The idea that this foreign vampire figure can take nice young British girls and turn them into predators.
Whew. Oh, the corruption. The corruption.
Exactly. And Lucy's no victim, right? When Lucy's that amazing scene in the novel, Lucy in her coffin. So good. And, you know, that's something that the movie chose not to even go there, which I can imagine many, many good special effects reasons not to go there. But narrative reasons too, I imagine.
Sarah, what's your favorite Universal monster? If you had to pick one of the classic Universal monsters, would it be Dracula?
Well, I would say Dracula is up there among them because he opened a lot of doors for the other ones. He set up Universal with the Dracula movie for them to be a house of horror movies later on. But overall, I would say Creature from the Black Lagoon.
And that's because of Julie Adams, isn't it, Sarah?
Yes.
Julie Adams just absolutely was amazing in that film. It wasn't the creature that was fantastic. It was her ability to really give the audience the real feeling, the real emotion of being in that situation.
She did a great job on that. And of course, I go back to the creature's design. I enjoy that. Of course, I'm all things Halloween and artwork. And you have to admire that suit. I think it's pretty convincing.
Well, if I wasn't going to dress up as Tiger King for Halloween, you know, I could definitely be a Dracula.
You would be a Frankenstein, my friend. The giant human that you are, you and I, the only costume we could possibly pull off is the Frankenstein.
Throw a couple bolts on your neck. And,
I've done that.
Sew your head up.
Oh, I've done that. Believe you me, there have been Halloweens at school where I have just been groaning at the children, and they go, "What's wrong with him? I don't know. It looks
why does he look like Herman Munster?"
Well, you were just staying in character, groaning at.
Yes, I've done that. There was one year that I went as a zombie. That was in college, and the professor was calling roll without looking up, and then I groaned instead of said present, and he looked up, and he startled. It was hilarious.
Brains!
I was not a brains zombie. I was a pre-brains zombie. This segment of the book is certainly a big action piece, isn't it, Pam?
Well, absolutely. And I think that when we get to the part of actually killing Lucy, it's just fascinating how all of that is described. So I was kind of curious how you guys read the staking Lucy scene.
I didn't read it the way you read it, I'll tell you that much. Jeez. Why don't you go ahead?
Light some candles and put on some.
I see this as the team is coming together and they are all there to fight evil, and they know what they need to do because Van Helsing has informed them. He is the informative part of the team. He's the leader because he knows what he's talking about, but the rest of the team is there.
I've opened the bottle of champagne and the strawberries are right
here.
All
right. So
let's get started.
Okay, Pam, how do you see the staking of Lucy scene?
I feel like I'm always just like, you know, ruining books for you guys. Please forgive me. So, like, spoiler alert from the world of literary criticism, this scene has often been read quite sexually. And so if we look at Jonathan Seward's diary, right before they go to stake Lucy, he says, It made me shudder to think of so mutilating the body of the woman whom I had loved. And yet, the feeling was not so strong as I had expected. It's pretty horrifying to think that you're going to, you know, like penetrate your loved one's body with a giant stake. You're going to have to use a hammer to do it. And then you're going to cut off her head, right? But...
So, sounds like a Black Widow.
I mean, and he says, you know, I didn't feel great about it, but I didn't feel as bad as I thought I would. And then listen to the description of the actual staking. Like, and it's all done very much through his own emotional tenor rather than any graphic description. When Lucy, I call the thing that was before us Lucy because it bore her shape, saw us, she drew back with an angry snarl, such as a cat gives when taken unawares. Then her eyes ranged over us. Lucy's eyes in form and color, but Lucy's eyes unclean and full of hellfire, instead of the pure, gentle orbs we knew. At that moment, the remnant of my love passed into hate and loathing. Had she then to be killed, I could have done it with savage delight. As she looked, her eyes blazed with unholy light, and the face became wreathed with a voluptuous smile. And so there's this way that Lucy becomes this like horrifyingly sexual creature, and she has to be penetrated by these men who are saving her soul from Dracula's influence.
God bless the English language. Yes, thank goodness for literature.
Yes, Pam, you're right. This sounds like a metaphor for something else that we're exploring with these multiple men and this woman. You're right, Pam. Ruining horror movies since 1972. I see this as the real struggle here is the idea of what is this creature? Is this creature Lucy? That point is made very clear in that segment that you read and others where this is mutilation of a body. This is against religion. This is against our beliefs. But... this is a monster at this point. This is no longer Lucy. And that is so well put in this text.
And I do think that in the movie, in the final scene, we get like Mina does a little bit of that, right? So as Dracula is being killed. And again, it's interesting how in the film, you turn away. You've got Renfield with the big hammer and the stake. And you turn away. And what you see when Dracula is being killed is actually Mina. And she is like clutching her breast because this is killing her too. But she hasn't been quite turned into a vampire yet. Oh boy, I can't wait for you guys to read the fourth part. The Mina section in the fourth part is like my favorite. So when you were like climax, I was like, ooh, almost the climax. We're so close. But yeah, I did think that like the way they staged the final scene was really well done. I like that a lot.
I found it very interesting that in the text, it states that if the vampire is killed for real, real killed, not undead killed, destroyed, then all of the victims, they will no longer have this, viral problem that they have, and they will also have no memory of having any of these encounters. They will go back to their normal state, and that's kind of what we're looking at in the movie, right? With Mina not quite being turned, and she's going to, when Dracula is destroyed, she will go back to normal, right?
Maybe. It's hard to tell, but once Dracula's dead, you know, she's probably going to have some trouble as well, because I would think that would have lingering effects once you're a vampire.
I completely agree.
Well, seems to last forever. No. I wanted to kind of address that from the book's point of view. That was, when I was reading that, I was like, what incredible powers. They kept increasing Dracula's powers. Not only can he live forever and become younger and all these other things, but now he can become mist with red eyes, and he has control over people, and And then you throw out this other thing, like if he no longer exists, like everybody goes back to normal. It certainly he has a profound effect on everybody, but certainly very incredibly a wide range of powers, I would say. Mm-hmm.
And you're right. It does. Bram Stoker here really is adding to the mythos of the vampire. And this is the mythos that we then take and move into all of these adaptations, including this idea of him working with the wolves, which certainly delves into the sparkly vampires, where the werewolves are one group of the creatures, and then there's the vampires who are the other group of the creatures, and you have to vote for one or the other, which is the lesser of two evils.
Or the more attractive of two evils.
Oh. Ooh, my. Ooh.
It's so fascinating because, like, as of the 1970s, the literature of the vampire splits into vampire romance and vampire horror, which are both very, very active and vibrant portions of vampire literature today. And so urban fantasy has your romance vampire, and obviously horror continues to have great, great vampire characters. And I kind of think when you go back to this 1931 film, you do see that a little bit. You do see that the vampire has those two potentials to be both seductive and terrifying.
A lot of cologne there.
I was fascinated that the movie showed Dracula interacting so much more in his human form with all of the characters. You know, like they meet at the opera house. He comes by to visit. Like he's, you know, he's a welcome member of their daytime life as well as a predator in the night.
And they take out the whole part about him getting younger, right? Is that in the, is there a scene in the 1931 where Bela Lugosi suddenly becomes younger? No.
Was he ever young? Was he? I think he was born.
Born an old grandpa from Hungary. Yes. Yes. That's all I think of is my grandfather and how careful he was not to have garlic in his dinner. Let's put it that way.
There's not enough paprika in this food. More. I'll have to smoke paprika.
And he didn't decorate with wolf's bang.
Exactly.
You're right. There was no wolf's bane or garlic necklaces in my grandfather's home. That is for sure. Very mysterious, this idea of where this myth comes from the Eastern Europeans. I'm not quite sure where it comes from. I don't drink wine.
And they all bring soil across the, you know, to scatter around the city, just in case you need to get somewhere. Escape. I must escape to one of my many apartments with my boxes of soil.
And in this section, we see that some of those boxes have been moved, and there's a second house that was purchased by Dracula under the pseudonym. Did you love the pseudonym that Dracula used to buy the second house, Pam?
Oh my God, I didn't notice it.
Count DeVille. As in, like, devil. Like, okay, Bram Stoker, we got you.
Does later on his daughter collect Dalmatians?
Yes. Yes! His granddaughter,
and she has
Cruella.
A wicked hairstyle, man.
with her smoky voice. What is that? Marlboro.
So we've got Lord Godalming and Count DeVille. Oh my goodness.
Right. Just very subtle.
Missing the good and versus evil.
It's the type of subtlety I like.
We see Mina in this section of the book really becoming so important to the story. She becomes a main character, the main character maybe, right here, Pam?
And this is what I find super fascinating about these chapters, is that Mina shows herself to be incredibly important. She organizes all the documents. We find out what we've been reading is her organization of the documents. This is kind of like awesome metafictional moment where we learn, like, hey, you're reading documents that are the story, that are created as part of the story. And she, her little typewriter, is like creating everything in triplicate, and everyone, she's organizing everything. She knows all the railroads, the schedules. I mean, she is organizing these guys into a fighting force against Dracula.
And handing out copies to everybody.
Exactly.
That's right. Here's your script.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to throw this out. Like Arthur Conan Doyle, Bram Stoker seems to be throwing out the technology of the time. Mm-hmm. We have the typewriter and the phonograph. And I mean, just certainly the modern way of dealing with people who have mental health issues. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just seems like we are on the verge of science.
And I love how Mina gets super excited about the phonograph. She says, Dr. Seward, in the phonograph, I can actually hear how much you love Lucy. Just so you know, sorry, buddy, but you know, this technology, it captures more than your words. It captures your emotions too.
And she says that she's going to be kind and take out that emotion when she does the typing, that the words that she types will not have that same quality of emotion. It speaks to that technology. We have a podcast instead of just a blog. The sounds of our voices certainly change the meaning of the words.
My robotic voice certainly helps out.
But then, you guys, at the end of this section in chapters 19 and 20, the men realize that, like, Mina, much like Lucy, looking a little pale, feeling a little haggard, a little struggling with her energy.
Mm-hmm.
So they realize, oh, this is too much for poor Mina. We can't have her be part of our big man business. We're going to have to give her rest. Let's not tell her anything else. And so that's where we leave things at chapter 20. And, you know, spoiler alert.
That's awful. First of all, she is like, she's made sure every one of these characters cross knowledge. You know, between them. Here's a cram strip of my husband's diary and my diary. And, you know, let me transcribe that so we can give it to everyone else.
And, oh, yeah, I've gone through the newspapers and pulled everything relevant from multiple dailies.
It's like she does everything, but immediately gets dismissed over here. You stay here. Well, we go out and die.
And beyond that, she is the caretaker of the story. She is taking care of Lord Godalming, who openly weeps in her arms in his grief. She says, I wish I could comfort all who suffer from the heart. Will you let me be your friend? And will you come to me for comfort if you need it? You will know later why I speak. There's so many things here, including Mina goes and takes care of Renfield. That's a part of the story that I was not expecting. That's certainly not in the 1931 story.
This is her story in many ways.
Mm-hmm. So one of the exercises I always have my students do when I teach this novel is I write the names of all the characters on the whiteboard and I say, create a map of how everybody interacts. And so Mina's always at the center, like Mina.
Hmm. Oh, yeah.
In some ways, you know, Mina and Dracula are the central characters of this novel.
So progressive.
Well, and here's the thing. I think it's really interesting that in the novel, 1897, so 35 years before this film, the men here at the place where we've stopped reading for this week, they decide, oh, in order to protect damsels in distress, we're going to have to, like, leave her out of our quest. And that turns out to be, like, a terrible idea. But in the film, 35 years later, it's a great idea. That's how you kill the vampire, is, like, protect the girl. She doesn't have to be part of the fight. So it's such a fascinating dynamic between those two representations. And, like, thinking about, like, 1931, we're in the interwar years, we're at the beginning of the Depression. I'm not sure. Like, it... that feeling of progress that comes at the end of the Victorian period is the feeling of depression that's in the 30s, I'm sure, is part of what's happening.
Interesting.
In addition, you have, like, I don't know, 90 minutes to get your story done, or an hour, or whatever the movie is.
And that brings to my question that I ask all the time. We know that the book is almost always better than the movie. And in this case, definitely this book is better than the movie. But what is your way of consuming pop culture? Do you prefer to watch the movie first or to read the book first? Sarah, do you have an opinion about that?
Well, I to read the book first because, like this movie, so much is left out. And you get the full story with the book, and I think it only adds to the movie. So when you're watching it, you say, oh, they left that out, but this is why they did that. I think you get the full story with the book, no pun intended, book, stories, yeehaw.
Pam, what's your opinion?
So, I mean, very similarly, I love to read very long books, and I like to spend a lot of time with characters, and so even the novel's not my favorite form. The series is my favorite form, right? I like books that are across many, many novels. But one thing that I thought about this movie especially, boy, did I like the castle. I thought those stairs were awesome. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of how they use the space was absolutely great. And having the final scene, the Dracula's death scene in the basement, and then having Harker and Nina climb up the stairs at the ending, that was just a really fascinating moment. And let's come back to that next week, my friends, as we finish this novel, thinking about the end, how the novel ends, which I don't want to spoil at this second, but also like how that gets represented with those, I don't know, how many stairs are there? Like 100 stairs? It's a huge, huge, huge staircase, mm-hmm. which Dracula carries Mina down the stairs. Renfield falls down the stairs. You know, I just thought the use of space, and I do think iconography of Dracula, how when we buy a Dracula costume, we're buying what's in that film, not what's mm-hmm. in that novel. And that has such a massive impact on pop culture. So I don't know, it's hard to say, which they're both so important to the way that we think about these characters.
Chip, do you have an opinion about the movie versus book?
Well, if it's Valentine's Day and I pull out a novel, I don't think it's going to go over in that way. So I'm going to have to like go to, we're going to go to the show. You know what I'm saying? We got to do something. But, you know, I prefer to listen to, you know, like a couple rambling guys talk to, you know, expert opinions of a recording. That probably is the best way to learn about this.
The book club is absolutely the right choice. I agree with you. The book club format is the best. I prefer, and I almost never do this. Bear this in mind. I almost never do this. I prefer to watch the movie first to have the skeleton that, as Chip has said in the past, that you can then hang the meat of the important parts of the novel on afterwards. To have in mind what those people who were the actors portraying those characters looked like when I'm imagining that during the reading of the book afterwards. Now, again, bear in mind, I almost never do that. When the book comes out, I almost always read the book when it comes out and then wait for the movie like everybody else. But that is, if I can imagine a young Steve watching Svengoolie in the 80s and seeing this Dracula from 1931, that certainly lends all of those characteristics of those characters to old man Steve reading this book in 2020, and I can imagine who these people are based on those actors.
Yes, and that's one thing. The book, you have to use your imagination, and then, like you said, the movie is the skeleton, the meat and the potatoes.
This has been great. I'm so glad that we get together and have these conversations. And every Saturday night, we get together and have conversations over Svengoolie. The Sven Pals, follow the hashtag Svengoolie every Saturday night. And Sarah, thank you so much for joining us this week.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, absolutely. We look forward to our Gather Together Apart that's going to happen not this Saturday, next Saturday, October 31st, Halloween night. Follow the hashtag Svengoolie and SvenPals as we watch Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman together, and we're going to have a lot of fun. Pam, we're not done with Dracula, right? We still have another episode. Pam, what's our assignment for next week?
Finish the book. That's your assignment. Finish this book. You're going to love the ending.
Chapters 21 through 27, the end of this book. We will love the ending. I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we can come back next week, Steve.
What do you think, Pam? Are we clear for next week?
We're good. And Sarah, thank you so much for coming.
This has been really fun. And I would tell you what I'm going to be for Halloween, but I don't want to spoil the surprise.
Ooh, we'll we can't all dress up as Tiger King.
Where can our listeners find more information about you, Sarah, and find out about your Halloween costume for our Gather Together Apart?
I'm at Dr. Rhodes on Twitter, and I'm always using the hashtag Sphingoolie. I do tweet about other things, but that's mostly for the Sphin Pals.
Nice. Wonderful work. This has been great. I look forward to the next couple of weeks because this is my favorite time of the year. I want to thank you again for listening to Sandwiches at Irregular Hours. I'm Steve Fodor.
And I'm Count Chepesso.
And I'm Pam Fedor.
We'll see you in the future.